Our is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, the nonprofit agency providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Blood donation. It's about life.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock, and in this portion of the afternoon magazine, we go to the archives for an interview with historian Laurent Dubois, author of Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution. This interview from May 12th of this year. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Today we try to get some perspective on the situation in Haiti, the poorest nation, the most desperate nation in the Americas. We'll talk about Haiti's history, in particular the Haitian Revolution of 1791, the Proclamation of Independence in 1804, and the legacies of slavery and colonialism in Haiti. Our guest is historian Laurent Dubois, an associate professor of history at Michigan State University. He is the author of Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution. The revolution was a slave revolution. It was the largest and only successful slave revolt in the history of the world. In 1791, thousands of brutally treated slaves rose up against their masters in the French colony of Saint-Domingue, then the most profitable colony in the 18th century Atlantic world. Between 1791 and the proclamation of 1804, more than 100,000 Haitians died. The economy that once produced half of the sugar and coffee in the world was wrecked. But our guest also says the events of the period were critically important, quoting here, in the broader struggles over the meaning of freedom and citizenship that shaped the Atlantic world during the 18th and 19th centuries. He says, quoting again, "The Haitian Revolution forever transformed the world." And the revolution had another political impact. Napoleon's loss of Haiti forced him to sell the Louisiana Territory to the United States. The purchase doubled the size of the U.S. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455, 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution by Laurent Dubois is published by Harvard University Press. Professor Dubois, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Would you share the two epigraphs that you have used to open Avengers of the New World and tell us about the men who made those statements?
Yes, that's an interesting question to start off with. These are two epigraphs that obviously gave the book the title. And one of them is written by an Enlightenment figure, an 18th century French writer, who wrote a very interesting book in which he, it was a kind of a time travel book, in which he woke up in the future and found the world to be perfected, and many of the problems that he had lived with in the 18th century resolved. And in one place, one plaza in Paris, he walks into a plaza, and this is what he says. He says, "I saw on a magnificent pedestal a Negro, his head bare, his arm outstretched, with pride in his eyes and a noble, imposing demeanor. At his feet were the words, 'To the Avenger of the New World.'" And when he's asked what this figure is, he's told that by a number of people that he is a hero who ended slavery in the Americas, who led the slaves to victory against their masters. So they're kind of calling, in a sense, in the 18th century, even before this revolution, for a kind of redemption to come from the slaves themselves. It's an interesting quote. Then years later, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, the founder of Haiti, in explaining some of the massacres that he has committed, declares that he's avenged America, and by which he means not only the black slaves, but actually also the indigenous people who had been killed in the Americas. So they kind of form bookends of the story I try to tell in the book.
Yeah. You write that the revolution began as a challenge to French authority by colonial whites. How did the revolution begin, and how was it transformed to a battle over racial inequality?
Well, the first stage, in many ways, many of the colonial whites in Saint-Domingue admired what had happened in the United States. Actually, they saw the United States as a kind of model. For them, what was important about what had happened in the United States was an independence, an economic independence from Britain, but also the preservation of slavery. And during the early years of the French Revolution, the planters had a kind of dual hopes and fears. On the one hand, they wanted to be freed from the monopoly that the French government held them in, where they had to sell their sugar at fixed prices and so forth. They wanted to be able to trade more freely. But they were also very afraid, especially as the revolution progressed, that the ideas of equality in the French Revolution would essentially stir up their slaves or would cause problems in the colonies. So there was a kind of breakdown of authority in Saint-Domingue, but also this new and I think an important new kind of discourse about liberty and freedom that influenced things. As well. So, but it's the crucial point in some ways is that the French Revolution did more, perhaps more than even than the ideological influences, that it did in some ways shatter the power structure in Saint-Domingue, things that this structure that was a very brutal structure, but that it held together, if only barely during the previous decades. And it did provide an opening both for free people of color, who were people of African descent, who were free but were denied many rights, and then eventually for the slaves themselves.
Yeah. Well, just to kind of make a clarification here so that we're looking at the same framework, the Haitian Revolution begins August 1791. The French Revolution began in 1789. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that these two revolutions go hand in glove.
Mm-hmm. They definitely do, and one of the points of the book is really to begin to think in an integrated way that we should all think about, I think, about really the American, the French, and the Haitian revolutions as a series, as a cycle of revolutions that influenced one another. And all of them were rooted before they began in this 18th century world, which is a very interconnected world in which ideas circulated, obviously products circulated and so forth. So to see these worlds as not so much as separate nations, we tend to think of them now as three different nations. But if you go back to the 18th century, this is a very, very integrated reality. So we can't really think of them separately, I would say. And often the French and American revolutions are often acknowledged in that way, but usually Haiti is left out of the picture, mm-hmm. and I think it's important to change that.
Yeah. Why do you suppose that is, that Haiti's been left out of the discussion?
Well, I think it's a number of things. I mean, part of it just has to do with the present day, right, which is that France and the United States are able to project a kind of a sense of their own history, obviously, in a way, on the broader stage. And there are a lot of institutions. There's an institutional power structure that goes with projecting that history. And Haiti is obviously in a very different situation. There have long been wonderful Haitian historians who've written about the history of Haiti. But outside of Haiti, that history has long been forgotten. And obviously, the situation of Haiti today influences how people think about the past. I get it. That's always the case. It's something that historians were always struggling against in a way. But it's difficult sometimes for people to imagine a world in which Haiti was actually at the center of enormous struggles, wars, and ideological battles. It's hard sometimes for people to picture that it was not on the margins, but rather at the mm-hmm. center at that time. So.
Well, on the one hand, and I think you say this in the book, the Haitian Revolution helped lay the foundation for the French Revolution, but on the other hand, the French Revolution fed the Haitian Revolution.
I think, yeah, to me, it's central to understand these things as a constant cycle in a way, is that, for one thing, the 18th century slavery in the Caribbean helps set the stage for the French Revolution in a very important way, which it actually generates a new class of people in France, who are some of the people who help lead that revolution. These are people who are not aristocrats, but become very wealthy through the Atlantic trade. So there's a kind of irony that historians have commented on, that the slave labor of the Caribbean helped set the stage for the struggle for freedom of whites in France. So even before the revolution, those connections are there. But I would say the way I try to put it is rather than just see the French Revolution influencing Haiti or vice versa, what you see is that some ideas, the very important ideas that emerge in 1789 about equality, could have contained a rather constrained meaning, as they did in the United States, actually. In other words, a freedom in principle for all people, but in practice one in which it's limited to males, it's limited to wealthy people, et cetera, et cetera. And what's dramatic about what happens in the Caribbean is that the slaves take on those ideas, they transform them, and they make them really what we think of them as today, which, in other words, a universalism that applies absolutely to everyone, that does not stop based on your color or your wealth. So there's a way in which they are more universalist than the French Revolution. They make it a broader and more compelling and radical set of ideas. So in that sense, that's why I attribute to them this great importance in the broader history.
So that is where we have the significance of the ideals of freedom and citizenship and human rights.
Mm-hmm.
They come to life in Haiti.
Definitely. I think, you know, there isn't really any more dramatic revolution I can think of than one in which a group of people who are literally chattel, who are literally property, have no rights whatsoever, rise up and ultimately become citizens and become founders of their own nation. It's obviously a very, very, you know, big journey, and one that happens very quickly and dramatically in Haiti.
It was the largest and only successful slave revolt in the history of the world. Why did it succeed? What made it so powerful?
That's always a puzzling and interesting question. I think, on the one hand, it's true that the very thing that made Saint-Domingue so important in the 18th century, the intensiveness of its system, and this was a very industrialized system, a very wealthy system. By the time of the revolution, about 40,000 Africans a year were being brought into the colony. But it was also brutal. It destroyed lives. It was so brutal, in fact, that at the time of the revolution, the majority of the population was African-born, because slaves did not reproduce themselves, and they died at such a high rate that they were constantly being brought into the colony. And that's one part of the story, which is that actually the people who fought this revolution, many of them were Africans. Many of them had actually fought wars in Africa. They were, as one historian, John Thornton, calls them, African veterans. And they knew how to fight, and they had very sophisticated military tactics that they used against Europeans. So that's part of the story, but there's also this remarkable set of individuals, I guess, or people and communities that managed to create a conspiracy that worked in Saint-Domingue. So often, again and again, for instance, in the U.S., slave conspiracies were betrayed before they happened. They came apart soon after they began, but the leaders in Haiti managed to keep it going, and they managed to win the first strike and to gain a foothold in the colony, and then from there they managed to negotiate their way to freedom.
Mm. The leaders of the revolt were also trusted by their masters. That also gave them a leg up, didn't
mm-hmm.
it?
It's true that many of the important leaders were what we call drivers. That is, that on the plantations there were slaves who were in charge of controlling other slaves. They were taskmasters. They actually meted out the whippings and so forth. So they had this ambiguous relationship where they were trusted by their masters, but also in some ways perhaps distrusted by other slaves. But nevertheless, many of these people ended up becoming leaders, and they were obviously in a very powerful position to lead the plantation slaves on these plantations into battle. So that is important, that there were these intermediary figures. And actually, Toussaint Louverture, one of the greatest figures, really the greatest figure of the Haitian Revolution, is someone who was free before the revolution and at one point even owned a slave briefly. So he was also in between different groups. And a lot of those people were the ones who became leaders. They were able to negotiate the different sides of the equation, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, the social hierarchy is very interesting, both on the side of color and on the side of the whites. And you note that the slaves sized up the social order in the colony and coined terms to describe the classes
mm-hmm.
of whites. Talk with us about the terms they used to classify whites, how it was they stuck, and what that meant for the colony.
Well, I try to suggest that there's a term that most people are familiar with when they read about the revolution, which is grand blanc, or big whites, and petit blanc, or little whites, right? And this was a distinction, and part of it is simply that by the middle of the 18th century, again, there's a kind of, this is the sort of Silicon Valley of the 18th century or something, there's a huge land boom in the 18th century, and by the middle of the 18th century, it's very difficult to get into the economy. So there's a class of people who've made a ton of money and really control things in the colony, but there's also constantly these white migrants arriving who are just trying to get a foothold into this world, and many of them fail, and they are very poor often. And the slaves, of course, I think part of the important thing here is that they were very sophisticated analysts of what was going on, and they saw very clearly that there was a lot of tension between poorer whites and richer whites. And they coined these terms. They also talked about white sheep, actually, that they used mouton blanc in part because so many of them died from diseases, and they later used this term to describe soldiers, the French soldiers who died in such great numbers in the colony, too.
Mm.
So these are these are the kind of little traces we get of their view, of their vision from the bottom up, and of how they saw possibilities for ultimately to intervene.
Yeah, these classes, we have planters and merchants, they're an alliance. The poor landless whites are kind of a different story. Mm-hmm. Did they have a stake in the revolution?
Well, they in some ways were, it's a very interesting, because they're kind of the equivalent, or what might have been the equivalent of the sans-culottes, or the kind of working class and artisanal classes who were so central in France in driving the rise of the Jacobins. And yet in Saint-Domingue, they directed a lot of their rage and anger not so much against the system in the colony as against wealthy free people of color who lived there. The kind of predictable response that we've also seen in the U.S., which is that there's an extent to which people sort of blame their problems on people of color as opposed to on broader things. But they attack these often very wealthy and very educated individuals of African descent who indeed are often much more powerful than they are, at least economically, and they own slaves themselves, and they ride, and they have a series of they're very, rather prominent society, even though they're also submitted to a number of increasingly racist laws as time goes on. So it's a very, very strange way in which the racial dynamics in the colony create a very different revolutionary context and diffuse perhaps some of the more radical roles that the poor whites might have played and do play in France.
Mm. Was there also a hierarchy of slaves?
Indeed. I mean, there's the whole, one of the big puzzles, and this is not just a puzzle for Saint-Domingue, but really for all the Caribbean colonies, and to the same extent for the southern U.S., which is how these systems worked, especially in the Caribbean, where there was 80% to 90% population of the enslaved, to make sure they stayed in check in some ways, and to sort of prevent them from rising up involved a whole series of calculations. One of them, as I talk about, was just this use of terror to terrorize the slaves and public whipping and executions and so forth. But the other was, of course, a kind of divide and counter technique, which was to create a hierarchy in the slaves, to provide certain of them with more access to goods and clothes and so forth. And again, this strategy didn't always work because obviously, as we mentioned, the drivers, the people who were in some ways privileged, if you can say that, were among those who rose up against their masters. So they recognized that ultimately they were still being held in check. But that was important, and there were differences among different groups and different experiences among different groups of slaves, and that affected how they viewed the revolution. And we need to think about them, obviously, as very complicated and very mm-hmm. varied group as well.
So. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they were controlled by terror and torture. It was a very violent, very violent life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and again, that's not unique to Saint-Domingue.
Right.
It's something you'll find in any slave society, obviously. But here, there was a way in which there was a very public, and there was actually a lot of debate about it even before the revolution. But there was the sense most masters essentially thought that you had to constantly cow and frighten the slaves. Otherwise, if you gave in for a moment, they would ultimately, respond with their own violence. So.
Yeah. Well, there was debate going on in the colony over the treatment of slaves. Also in France, mm-hmm. there's an abolitionist movement.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned at the outset, the dream of the man who dreams, the Avengers of the New World.
Mm-hmm.
What was the discussion in France? What was happening in France that we have this thinking about slavery and the injustice of it?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of the experience, for one thing, just not only of slavery, but of encounter with Native Americans and others, a lot of the experiences in the Americas really did shape Enlightenment thinking. It raised a lot of issues about the nature of humanity, about cultural difference, about what was truly natural and what was truly human about people. And many writers, most of whom never set foot in the Caribbean or left France, became concerned with the issue of slavery and saw that there was a kind of immorality or an unequalness. And were concerned about that. Some of them took more political action against it than others, and there was a lot of contradiction sometimes in their thinking. It should also be said, there's a wonderful book by historian Sue Peabody about cases that slaves brought against their masters. These are slaves in France itself, and they brought these very high-profile cases in which they claimed that there was no slavery in metropolitan France, so in France within Europe, or that there should not be slavery there. And many of them actually won their freedom, and this was in the media and so forth. So it's not just a distant problem, but in Paris itself, there were these court cases going on. So I think a certain number of people did come to feel that that slavery was itself a violation of humanity, and that ultimately it had to be destroyed. And that's what Mercier was evoking, was that in his evocation and in others' evocation, essentially, if the whites didn't get rid of it themselves, one day the slaves would. And that was his warning, in a sense, was that if it wasn't eliminated through peaceful means, it would have to be eliminated through more violent ones.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the U.S. now a couple of times, and in the book you say that the Haitian Revolution was part of the destruction of slavery in the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
That slavery was destroyed in the Americas in the mid to late 19th
yeah.
century.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it took some time.
Yes.
You want to share some thoughts on that in that regard?
Yeah, I think there's actually a kind of contradictory influence of the Haitian Revolution, which is obviously, as you mentioned, it makes possible the Louisiana Purchase. And the Louisiana Purchase makes possible an enormous
yeah.
expansion of slavery in the United States. That's really an important point, as well as an expansion of slavery in Cuba is also the result of the Haitian Revolution. So certainly it doesn't sound the death knell of slavery, and slavery continues to thrive and expands and so forth. And historians, there's a great deal of debate about this, but I come down on the side of saying that ultimately I do think that once the Haitian Revolution has happened, once it becomes possible for slaves everywhere to imagine that you can rise up and succeed, and once these leaders have come on the world stage challenging ideas of racial ideas and so forth, there is, of course, a backlash against what they did, but I would say that, that once that has happened, in a sense, it sets things on a path towards the end of slavery. Perhaps not inevitably, but it remains an inspiration. It's a central part of the story, and more, even just more from the perspective of kind of self-preservation, whites have to begin thinking differently about this. And from then on, it's always the case that masters have to at least think about the fact that there may come a time when they will pay for being slaveholders, and that vengeance is a possibility and has at least in one case happened. So there's a sense in which I think it triggers new ways of thinking about things. Which is not to say, of course, that people immediately, you know, turn against slavery. In fact, in some ways, people use Haiti as an excuse to become even more racist and brutal in some ways. So it's not an unambiguous story, but I still think it's crucial in the longer sweep of history of the elimination of slavery. Interestingly, it's the case that some, especially in the African-American communities, people will invoke Toussaint Louverture and will invoke
yeah.
these leaders throughout the period in the 19th century. So.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should talk about Toussaint. He's an interesting character, and I had no idea that he was so flawed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's tragic.
Right. Yeah, I think that, I mean, it's, you know, part of the thing is that, of course, every leader probably, when they come into power, makes mistakes or is flawed in some ways. But what I try to emphasize in the book, too, is that Toussaint Louverture he inherited an enormously difficult problem, and it's actually a problem that, as I mentioned, essentially every other person who tried to resolve this problem failed as well, if you think about it, and if you think about, you know, the U.S. during Reconstruction or other places. So I don't want to emphasize, in a sense, the challenge he faced. But he does, in a curious way, he becomes so committed, in a sense, to preserving emancipation that in some ways he undermines the meaning of that emancipation. And I think that's part of the central drama and contradiction of the story in Haiti, but in other places as well, which is that the force of slave-owning empires and the force of this broader demand for colonial commodities is so strong during the era that even though most slaves would really like to do something else, they would really envision a different kind of reality for themselves, Toussaint Louverture concludes that it's only by continuing to produce sugar and coffee that the Haitians will be able to preserve even the freedom that they have. So in some ways, you know, and I do think it's important to emphasize that the order that he creates is very coercive, but it's not slavery. It's not the same thing. It has important differences. And the people in Haiti are wise enough to know that there's a difference. And when Napoleon wants to go back to slavery, even though the world is not perfect, they fight to preserve at least what they've gained. But certainly he is kind of a tragic figure in certain ways, in the sense that he's unable to find a compromise or some way to really fulfill the dreams that most of the people in Saint-Domingue have for their freedom.
Yeah. Well, let's back up to 1793. This is before Toussaint Louverture comes to leadership and to power.
Mm-hmm.
In 1793, Britain and Spain declare war mm-hmm. on France And that had an impact on Haiti.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, again, going back to the centrality of Saint-Domingue within the colonial world, this was a place that a lot of other empires dreamed of taking over. It was so wealthy. So both, and a big part of actually the French Revolutionary Wars are fought in the Caribbean. There's 60 to 80,000 British troops that die just in the Caribbean during the 1790s, so it's really a major field of battle. But that, of course, creates a really dramatic situation for the colony, and it opens the way for this dramatic abolition of slavery that happens in 1793, because essentially the French Republican leaders who are in Saint-Domingue come to realize that they don't have anyone on their side, because many of the colonial whites have now turned firmly against France, are actively making ties with Britain, who they hope will preserve slavery. Many of the insurgents are actively fighting for Spain, which has been giving them weapons and supporting them in a bid to take over the colony. And so they make this rather bold and ultimately brilliant move, which is to grant freedom to those insurgents who will fight for France. And this begins a transformation in the colony. And ultimately, they are forced essentially to abolish slavery outright. What's important about that moment is that they did not leave France with any such orders to do so. They do that on the ground in the Caribbean in direct response to what the slaves have been doing for the past years. So it's really dramatic, and it's dramatic, too, because they abolish slavery immediately and with no period of transition, which is not something that any abolitionist had even envisioned doing. The abolitionists of the time thought you should do this quite slowly, over a course of several decades and so forth. So what they do in the Caribbean is a kind of untheorized and totally new thing, with dramatic consequences. And then it's the second remarkable point is that it's then approved in France as well and extended to the French Empire.
Temporarily.
So for 8 years. but that itself is, if you think about this parliament in Paris agreeing the abolition of slavery in 1794, at the time when slavery was at its height, it's a pretty dramatic decision. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in 1802, Napoleon looks across the Atlantic and he wants the colony back.
Mm-hmm.
Too much independence. He sees its wealth. He wants it back. And you believe he wanted to reinstate slavery.
I think so. That's one of the toughest issues here. It's interesting because it ranks for me as one of the sort of massive blunders, historical blunders one can think about. It, precisely because what we spoke about earlier with Toussaint Louverture, he was offering the French really a very, very conservative order, one in which plantations would still function, in which they would have a power base in the colony of ex-slaves in the army and so forth. All he was asking, in a sense, and of course it was too much for the time, but in a sense it was not much, was that he was asking for racial equality in the leadership. He was asking for a space be made for him and other members of people of African descent to be part of this power structure. And that evidently was too much for Bonaparte to ultimately accept, although he later came to regret his decision about that. And the French do ultimately reestablish slavery in another island, Guadeloupe, that I've written about in another book, but that they do successfully reestablish slavery in Guadeloupe. And in Saint-Domingue, when the people there realize that this is really the ultimate intent, they begin a fight that's a fight to the death, literally, liberty or death, quite literally. That's when they really win the war. It's a massive blunder, and it's a huge, huge cost in terms of lives, of course, on both sides as well. So it's really a sad moment. And what's interesting about it is actually we know in some ways very little about exactly how and why they came to that decision, or maybe we'll learn more about it as more research is done.
Yeah. Tell us more about Toussaint Louverture in terms of, from our perspective today, my perspective, it seems he asked so little. He asked too little,
mm-hmm.
but yet it was seen as too much.
Mm-hmm.
How did he come to ask for what he asked for?
Again, it's hard to imagine what else he could have done in the world as it was, and I think that's part of the crucial thing in understanding the long-term history of Haiti afterwards, which is that Haiti had been constructed with one purpose, which was to produce exportable commodities for Europe. Right? It produced sugar mm-hmm. and coffee for Europeans. That's what was its foundation, and the whole place was constructed about on that. Of course, that's not what the people who were there, who had been enslaved there, wanted themselves to be doing. But how to transition from, right, it is a problem that many other colonies have seen, but how to transition from that very, very limited economic model that's about empire and about export for empire into something more sustainable was an enormous difficulty. And he concluded that to preserve freedom in this ocean of slavery, I guess is one way to put it, you had to keep giving Europe what it needed. You had to keep giving it sugar and coffee at whatever cost. And then maybe within that you would be able to carve out a space of freedom that was at least better than what had come before. So that's, in the end, his decision, but maybe, you know, was it the right decision? Was it the wrong decision? It's very hard to really calculate these things. But it is remarkable that the French government under Bonaparte was not able to see that that was at least better than what transpired once they made this rather brutal decision to try to return people to slavery, if you can imagine.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. Well, one in this instance, you know, asks, what if? Mm-hmm. You know, what if the plantation system had been truly reformed? Mm-hmm. And what if Napoleon Bonaparte had left them alone?
Mm-hmm. It's hard to know. I mean, I do think that this is where we get into counterfactual history. But for instance, one of the things that Bonaparte himself admitted, actually, was that militarily it would have been very smart for France to work with Toussaint Louverture, because as long as they could recruit people of African descent to fight in a French army in the Caribbean, they didn't need to send troops to the Americas, right? They had their homegrown army there. And as long as their enemies, Britain, and especially Britain, was still a society which was still had slavery in their colonies, Britain had to send troops across the ocean to defend its colonies, because they weren't going to recruit slaves. They did in small numbers, but not in large numbers. So militarily, you can imagine a very different context in which Bonaparte and Toussaint Louverture in league essentially worked to expand the French Empire or defend it as it was. And that's where, of course, the history of Louisiana might have looked rather different. And, of course, the history of the North America in broad terms. I mean, perhaps, you know, there was no way for people to act that way. But I do, one of the things I want to emphasize in the book, again, is that there were a lot of quite remarkable Europeans, a man, Etienne Lavaux, for instance, who was a French aristocrat, who were quite remarkable in what they did at this time, in their friendship with Toussaint Louverture and their support of the slaves and the ex-slaves, and in their support even for the idea of reparations for slavery and so forth, or at least mentioning the idea. So there's this quite remarkable group of people who, you know, maybe quite different from what we would imagine the thought in the 18th century.
Hmm. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is historian Laurent Dubois, an associate professor of history at Michigan State University. He's the author of Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution. Listeners, you can join the discussion with questions, comments. Here are the telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's go back now a couple hundred years at least in the history of the island, the colony. Columbus landed on the island in 1492, mm-hmm. and he brought sugarcane. Did it become a Spanish colony at that time? When did the French arrive?
It becomes a Spanish colony very early on, although the primary focus for Spanish colonization is the other half of the island, which is now the Dominican Republic, and the town of Santo Domingo, which by the early 16th century has a university and a church and is quite a center, an important center there. So the Spanish claim the island, which they call La Española, becomes known as Hispaniola, still is, and they claim that as part of their colonial expansion in the Americas. The thing about the Spanish, of course, is that once they move into Mexico and South America, the Caribbean becomes much less important to them. There's a brief period in which sugar cane is grown, and there are sugar plantations in Hispaniola, but that seeds gives way ultimately to a focus on other regions, obviously on Mexico and South America. So in the end, the Spanish in the Caribbean, the Caribbean zones are really kind of stopping points for ships bringing silver from the rest of Latin America. And the French begin, it's this sort of famous story of the pirates, right? By pirates of the Caribbean, the French begin their settlement, like the British, with piracy, with attacking the Spanish. And little by little, there's this illegal settlement that happens on the western portion of Hispaniola, which eventually becomes an official French settlement, and eventually the Spanish agree in 1697 to cede half of the island to the French. And that's really when Saint-Domingue is born, quite remarkable in a sense, is that this is a colony that essentially existed for a century and had this massive impact, but it was a very, very short-lived experiment in some ways.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's talk with this caller. Somebody in Charleston on the toll-free line, line 4. Go ahead.
Yes. Historically, first, I'd like to ask your guest industrialization, by which I mean steam power and factories and things like that, were established in England first and Scotland. Is that right?
The steam power, certainly, yeah. I mean, that happens later in a little bit later, I believe in the early 19th century, mm-hmm. And eventually does get brought to the Caribbean, actually.
Yes.
In terms of industrialization, there is a way in which the sugar plantations, they don't use steam, they use water and other kinds of processes. But the boiling process, the boiling process that creates the sugar, is a rather industrial process. It involves all these vats and operating 24 hours a day and so forth. The historians tend to describe these sugar plantations as a mix of field and factory. But there was an element of the factory and labor routines and a lot of other things that comes to really define industrialization in the 19th century are very much at work in the 18th century in the Caribbean,
yes.
Although, of course, with slaves rather than with wage laborers.
Yes. Well, then that leads to my next observation. The Industrial Revolution in Western Europe and then its transition across the Atlantic to the U.S., in heavy industry, then came later, I'm pretty sure, to America,
mm-hmm.
When the industrial plants were set up and mass production began,
right.
and such. Well, which leads me to my central thesis is that, Karl Marx was the first to write about it in the 1840s, about wage labor, or as he termed, in which I agree, wage slavery.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, and I've thought about this a great deal, the transition from slave labor, chattel slavery, which the slave, wherever they're, I suppose, as you've just articulated, which is good news for me, about the slave was cheap, and cheap to maintain,
mm-hmm.
Whereas in a so-called civilized society, slavery abhorrent on its own, then with the evolution toward technology and further mass production, that the chattel slave was too expensive. Would that be a fair observation?
I guess so. I guess there's such a complicated evolution in the 19th century. I don't know you probably have read Eric Williams' book, Capitalism and Slavery, which tries to look at this a little bit. I think there's so many factors that go into the transformation in the 19th century and the end of slavery. But certainly it's true that there's a way in which the slave labor is cheap in some ways. It's obviously not cheap in human terms, but it's cheap for planters at a certain point.
Yes.
And it's a kind of system that works, but that is predicated on the exertion of an enormous amount of violence, both in the slave trade and in the colonies itself. So perhaps it's ultimately an unsustainable system. But I don't know if that partially answers your question, but I would say that that's correct, that ultimately there's this process of transformation in the 19th century. And the point that Eric Williams made and that people have contested back and forth, but it is important to know, too, that a lot of the capital that gets invested in the 19th century in Europe is generated from slave labor in the Caribbean. So there's a process there where the Caribbean kind of contributes to European development in very important ways without necessarily sowing much of the profit, ultimately, certainly not in the case of Haiti.
Well, the Spanish must have found in indigenous peoples, ready-made slave force. Would that be, they could just round them up?
They did certainly try that first off, and what they found is that it did not work very well for various reasons. For one thing, so many people were decimated, and especially, in Hispaniola was perhaps the worst of any place in terms of the deaths from smallpox and other diseases.
Yes.
These populations were wiped out so quickly that they did not serve that purpose, and they also tended to really resist, to often commit suicide and so forth when they were forced into forced labor. Whereas Africans were in some ways were brought in a different way and were controlled in a different way. So that experiment, although it was attempted certainly enslaving indigenous people, did not last that long and did not work so well. although it took different forms in other parts of Latin America as well. But certainly that was attempted as well.
Yes. And my last, I'll bring us to the 21st century. Now with labor per se, I think the stats are saying that the U.S. is 80% service work. Now the industrial age is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And now with technology, that the need for human labor is going to be minimized in the 21st, and if we last to the 22nd century, which I'm very dubious about, the huge masses of people, now we have 6.2 billion people in the world, and capitalism offers absolutely no support. If you can get out and get the money on your own, that's fine, but if you don't, they don't give a damn. And if that being the paradigm by which we have evolved and are now into it in its synthetic stage, what then, I pray, is the future? And thank you very much, sir. I enjoy the show, Celeste.
Thank you.
Bye.
You want to comment on the comment?
That's a very difficult question. It's hard to know how to. I do think that it's very interesting to go back to this history of slavery and to reintegrate it into our understanding of work and labor and how these things evolved, because it was a central part of the history of Europe and has not been acknowledged often as such. And that's quite important, that I try to emphasize throughout my work, which is that we can't imagine or we can't understand the wealth that was produced in Europe and the new technologies and the new investments and all those sorts of things without understanding that it emerged from this earlier system. Whether that had to be that way or not is another question, but that's important to at least acknowledge the connections there.
Yeah, as you point out in the book, the livelihood of as many as a million Frenchmen depended on colonial trade.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to wrap it up here, and I want to go to a big question to end with, so I want to get to it right away here. We've touched now on six centuries, the sixth now being the 21st century. This history of Haiti, the years of conflict at the end of the 18th century and into the 19th century, what were the costs and what scars remain? How is Haiti affected today by this history?
Well, I think it's quite deeply affected in many ways. I mean, one is simply that what I had mentioned earlier with Toussaint Louverture, the problem of moving from that economy that was set up in the colonial system to something better, something that was more humane, was an enormous hurdle, and in some ways one that was never quite resolved. And that, I think, is one of the explanations. People wonder why Haiti remains quite poor. It's not the only explanation, but the starting point was a very, very difficult one. All of that money that was produced by this labor in the 18th century in Haiti went elsewhere. None of it was really became part of Haiti itself. They were not able to reinvest that in a new thing. So that's part of the story. Of course, the war itself, the cost that Haitians had to pay for their liberty was enormous in terms of deaths, in terms of the destruction and so forth. So that, too, was a difficult starting point. But I think as important as well is that Haiti has remained a kind of both a symbol of liberation, but also for a long time was seen as a symbol of barbarism and of danger and so forth. It was isolated. It was in many ways treated quite badly by the powerful nations of the 19th century, and that contributed to its difficulty economically and on other levels, and that's important. I think the crucial thing to understand is that for a variety of reasons, both internal choices that have been made in Haiti and the kind of enormous pressures that are placed and that have been placed and are still placed, negative pressures on Haiti from the outside have really together formed a very, very difficult situation in which Haitians struggle, many of them for just the basic needs, the basic necessities. And I think it's important to understand that history so that we can find ways to work to resolve that in a better way in the future.
Hmm. What's the likelihood of that?
I don't know. I like to remain optimistic. I know that Haitians have an enormous capacity and enormous intelligence, obviously, and are seeking ways to find solutions and are not always finding much help from outside to do that in a way that's really appropriate and the best for Haiti. So I remain hopeful. I mean, there are obviously aspects of what's gone on in Haiti that are extremely difficult to deal with. There are also, hopeful developments in different ways. It's never easy, but I do think that ultimately the best thing is to try to look towards some more positive future.
Mm. So. There, we'll leave it. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
My pleasure. Historian Laurent Dubois has been our guest this afternoon. He's an associate professor of history at Michigan State University. He's the author of Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution. The book is published by Harvard University Press. And that interview with Professor Dubois was conducted on May 12th of this year. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Let's find out what happened today in the end. Todd Gleason is with us this afternoon. Hi, Todd.
Good afternoon to you, Celeste, at the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon. Celeste, in the corn pit futures, managed losses for the day down anywhere between a quarter cent to 2.5 for the day. The beans were a gainer. Let's start in the wheat pit there, where futures were a bit higher. The nearby September contract at 335.5 settlement price today at 2.25 higher. The December contract at 348, they were up a quarter of a cent. Now let's get the highs and the lows there. September had a high of 337.5, a low at 330. Settlement price once again at 335.5, up 2.25. December wheat, 350.5, the high, the low at 343, settled 348. They were up 2 for the day. The March contract in the wheat pit, 360.5, the high, the low at 355, settled 358.5, up 2.75 on the day. In the May futures, 364, the high, the low at 360, settled 361.5, finished the day one higher. July contract in the wheat pit for next year, 362, the high, the low at 355.5. July 05 wheat settled 360.5 at the Board of Trade, up 4 cents on the day. From the corn pit, the nearby September contract had a high today of 238.25. Their low, 235.5, up, or rather down a quarter of a cent on the settlement price. They were settled at 237 in the September futures. December contract for 246.25, the high, the low at 243.5. Settlement there at 245, down 2.5. And the March corn, 254, the high, the low, 251.5, settled 252.75, 2.5 cents lower. May contract in the corn pit now, 259.75, high, low, 257.25, settled 259, down 1/4. July futures, 263.5, the high, the low, 261, settled 262.5, down 0.25 cents. And the September contract, 263.25, high, low at 260, settled 263, unchanged for the day from the September corn pit. From the oats now, September futures, 138.5, the high, the low at 134, settled 134.5, down 2.5 cents. And the December oats, 143.5, the high, low at 140.5, settled 140.75, down 0.25 cents. From the soy complex, the nearby beans, August contract, a settlement price there unchanged today. Had a high of 721.5, a low at 701.5. Settlement price at 707.5 once again was unchanged in the August soybeans. September futures, 670, the high, the low at 650, a 20 cent trading range, settled at 658, up 7 for the day. And November beans, 658.75, the high, the low at 639, settled 647.75. They finished the day 7.25 higher. The January contract, 663, the high, the low at 646, settlement price at 652.75, up 8.25 on the day. And the March futures, 665.5, the high, low at 648.5, settlement at 657.5 for the March soybeans, up 7.5 cents. The nearby, or rather deferred, May contract, 655, the high for the day, or rather the low for the day. The high was at 664, a settlement price at 655.75. They were up 8.25 on the day. Bean meal, August contract, 245.50, the high, the low at 238.50, settled 242. They were up 120 on the day. And the September's, 225.50, the high, the low at 221.50, settled 222.40. They finish 60 higher. The nearby August bean oil, 26.62, the high, the low at 26.23, settled 26.28. They were down 7. And the September contract finished the day unchanged, 25.90, the high, the low at 25.50, a settlement price there at 25.65, unchanged for the day. From the Mercantile Exchange, now the numbers are in, and here's Celeste Quinn with a look at those. Celeste?
Thank you very much, Todd, and it was a higher day today for livestock prices. Feeder cattle, August feeders, 109.90 the high, 108.45 the low, 109.07.5 the settlement at up 55. September, 108.75 the high, 107.60 the low, 108.20 the settlement, that up 60. October, 106.70 the high, 105.55 the low, 106.62.5 the settlement, that up 72.5. August live cattle, 83.75 the high, 82.67.5 the low, 83.10 the settlement, that up 2.5. October live cattle, 86.10 the high, 85 even the low, 85.85 the settlement, that up 45. Augustine Hogg, 74.25 the high, 73.25 the low, 74.22.5 the final price, that up 107.5. October, 65.40 the high, 64.55 the low, 65.27.5 the settlement, that up 87.5. December lean hog, 61.25 the high, 60.80 the low, 61.22.5 the settlement, that up 35. And February lean hog, 60.75 the high, 60.20 the low, 60.67.5 the settlement, that up 30. July bellies, 112.95 the high, 109.40 the low, 112.35 the settlement, that up 70. The Dow is down 14 points at 10,125. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500 have turned higher. The NASDAQ up 8 points at 1891, and the S&P 500 up 3 at 1104.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Verde Gallery, currently showing Vision to Verse, Verse to Vision, a visual and poetic dialogue, paintings by Jessica Damon and poetry by Maj Regain. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom featuring hundreds of unique magazines at 11 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at www.verdant-systems.com. Be inspired.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Milton Bradley from Springfield, Oregon writes, Dear Dr. Science, was the Frisbee named after a guy named Frisbee or Whammo?
Neither. Frisbee is a Latin word meaning convoluted spiral. It refers to a truncated hyperboloid, a three-dimensional representation of the algebraic function x equals 2y squared over z, where z is an irrational number that's currently behaving somewhat normally. The lightweight discus that college students throw to irritate the rest of us got its name from a particularly athletic mathematician who was apparently on something at the time. This was back in the late 60s when psychic voyagers were the rule, not the exception. The slang word to describe this was being whammed, and the expletive to describe an insight was whammo.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
To order the Dr. Science book kit with new hardback book, best of series tape, and honorary master's degree, $27.95, call 800-989-DUCK.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, cookies, coffee, extra virgin olive oil, and featuring a selection of new cheeses every week. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. This is WILL, Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today for the afternoon.